they say Alaska is a red state, but it has a way of electing Democratic governors fairly often. Two legislative veterans are vying for that shot. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. We have a resource-dependent past, and what kind of future do we want, and how do we get there? Ethan Berkowitz has some ideas. Our lines are open at 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, local call in Anchorage, 550-8422, email talk@aprn.org. Ethan Berkowitz is our guest on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
Ethan Berkowitz, welcome back to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here again.
I think the last time we had you on, you were running against Don Young.
I think that could have been the last time I was on here.
Yeah. And, he won, I think.
To his surprise and to the surprise of pundits across the country.
But it was kind of a cliffhanger for a while.
It was a little bit of a cliffhanger. And, now I've had the opportunity to run for governor, which I think is a better job, gives me more of an ability to help Alaska achieve its potential. And so it all could have worked out for the best as far as I'm concerned.
You know, when Sarah Palin stepped down and Sean Parnell took over, pretty rapidly he did a talk of Alaska, and he said, well, you know, the third floor has had this reputation of not being involved, which, as you know, is kind of code for the fact that the governor was not choosing to really be hands-on with the legislature. And he said, well, it's going to be very different with me. He said the third floor is going to be very involved. Hey, do you think he's come through with that?
Well, I know he did hire two legislators, so I guess he is more involved with the legislature that way. But Sean Parnell has not been very engaged, and his lack of leadership is part of the problem, part of the reason why Alaska needs to change. And Alaska needs a leader who's got a clear sense of direction, who's got the toughness we need to follow through on our projects, and who's willing to take initiative. And Sean Parnell, frankly, is not that guy.
So you were announced, I guess, a little over a week ago, I don't need to spend any more money on the primary. You're feeling pretty confident now?
Well, that's not exactly what I said, and far be it for me to criticize a reporter for taking something out of context, but that's not exactly what I said. I feel confident about the primary. We've run a good, solid race. Our message is clear, and I keep saying we can't keep doing what we've been doing. It's just not good enough for Alaska. That resonates well across the state, and I've traveled broadly. I've listened to what people have to say, and I have reason to be confident about the primary election, and I'm also confident about the ability to win in November, and that's going to be a crucial distinction, a crucial ability.
Well, when Hollis French was in here, your main opponent in the primary election, you know, he's a senator. You were a House member. He was quick to jump on the oil taxes, and his point essentially was that you might have made a kind of a misstep by calling for converting to taxing royalties on the oil and gas produced on the North Slope. And I wanted to give you a chance to explain what you're talking about, which takes a while, I know, and why.
Look, Alaska faces some real challenges. We need to encourage oil production from the North Slope. Oil is responsible for 80 to 90% of our state budget. It provides a huge amount of support for the entire economy. We're facing declining production. We need to do things differently if we're going to sustain production and keep the Trans-Alaska pipeline system full. So I've proposed a system that allows us to be flexible in our approach to the oil industry. It, in essence, builds on the reality of how we deal with the industry today. Currently, there's one system in place, ACES, that taxes the industry. And I think we're not doing a good job preserving that wealth. That wealth is spent on an annual basis. And because it's spent on an annual basis, the state budget goes up and down. It's erratic in terms of the state funding streams, and it creates uncertainty as far as the investment climate in this state. What I've proposed doing is making sure we build on the genius of the permanent fund, which is to take the non-renewable wealth of oil and convert it into something renewable. But instead of simply doing it for a piece of the royalty that the state gets, I want to do it for royalty and the severance, which is the tax component. I also believe that the more flexibility we have, the greater our ability to encourage production and help the economy grow strong.
Well, I think, were you in the legislature for the ACES debate? Or
I was not in the legislature for that debate. I was in the legislature when Frank Murkowski put his proposal forward. And I've been very clear. I think that the state was stuck in a bad system under the ELF regime, the economic limit factor. I fought to change that, and I stood up
You're being accused of wanting to go back to ELF, I believe.
Well, you know, it's the political season, and folks will make ridiculous charges in order to advance their own political agendas. But my record is clear, and people want to look at the record. I'm proud to stand on it. I've always stood up for a strong Alaska. I want to make sure that we have the rights of a sovereign. We're the owner state. We ought to be in control of the development of those resources to the maximum extent possible.
So when what you end up with, then you said you would go back to a severance tax. Is that what I'm hearing?
No, there is a severance tax now. And just as a quick overview.
Well, as I understand it, ACES and the Murkowski tax that preceded it was essentially an income tax. Just had a lot of deductions.
It is. And just a quick overview is Alaska gets revenue from oil in four forms. We get it from property taxes on the facilities. We get it from corporate income tax. We get it from royalty, which is the state's share of oil. We roughly get 1 out of 8 barrels belong to the state. And we get it from severance. Severance has become ACES. Severance is, in essence, the selling price of the commodity. When a leaseholder acquires a lease, they've acquired the right to take oil out of the ground, but they have to buy the oil once it comes out of the ground. That's severance. And from my perspective, both royalty and severance constitute the state's oil wealth. And we've got to protect that for future generations. There's something unfair about this generation of Alaskans are spending that oil wealth today, because what it does is we take away the ability of future generations to enjoy the benefits of oil that's been cooking in the ground for millions of years. We've got to change that structure.
So your main aim then is to incentivize exploration and production?
There's two aims. The first is to build a fiscal system for the state that's stable and make sure that the economy is on a sound footing in the future. And the second is to make sure that we have an investment climate that encourages exploration and development that's flexible. Right now, under ACES, you in essence have a one-size-fits-all tax structure. That's just not good enough. And you're already seeing erosion under the ACES structure. There's proposals in the legislature currently to carve out exceptions for cooking like gas, for example. And all my proposal does is recognize the realities that there's different economics for different fields, different geology for different fields, and allow us to be flexible in our approach. Instead of having the legislative arena be the place where oil negotiations occur, and I've seen corruption around that, corruption that sent people to jail, I think that we should have professionals do the negotiation subject to statutory requirements that the legislature can and should put in place. So what that would do is add another layer of protection for the state and another layer of protection against corruption.
Okay, I don't want to rag this into the ground. I'm sure the listeners will have some questions. But still, how could the state possibly hire good enough lawyers to compete with the investment we've already seen the oil industry put into their lawyers?
But we do that today. And the current system, you're seeing exceptions being carved out of this one-size-fits-all tax. And there are in place opportunities for leaseholders to seek what's known as royalty relief, subject to all kinds of statutory requirements. So we've got the ability to do this right. And I saw the corruption. I saw the consequences of $9 oil when I began my public service in the legislature. We've got to do things differently.
Okay, you ready for some questions?
I am always ready for questions.
Okay, we got one on internet from talk@APRN.org. And on the phone, we've got Don, joins the program from Anchorage. Don, you're on the air with Ethan Berkowitz.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Berkowitz. Thank you for taking my call. I have two questions that I would like to ask, and then I'll take my answer off air. The first question is, in your mind, do you believe the risk that the pebble mine poses for Bristol Bay salmon stocks is worth the development of that mine? And based on your answer there, do you support the pebble mine project?
There are a lot of great mining projects in the state of Alaska. Pebble is not one of them. I spent three seasons commercial.
Thank you, Joe.
Commercial fishing in Bristol Bay, and I'm very sensitive to protecting the stock and protecting the marketing that goes into having pure wild stock. It's critical for Alaska. I do not believe protections are in place that guarantees that our wild salmon would be safe from pebble development the way it currently is configured. And part of this has to do with the way that Frank Murkowski undid the procedural protections that used to exist. We used to have a coastal zone management plan that was robust and allowed local communities to have a meaningful say in development that occurred in their backyard. Part of this has to do with undoing of the mixing zone regulations that once were in place. Part of it has to do with the dysfunction that's still surrounding the movement of the Habitat Division from Fish and Game to Department of Natural Resources, which is not its natural home, and now back to Fish and Game. It hasn't been fully integrated, and the procedural protections are not in place. So at this point, I am not in favor of Pebble, and I have opposed it consistently since I first learned of the project.
And I think French is just as opposed as you are.
Well, he can speak to his own self, but I will tell you that when the project was first appeared, I was one of the original co-signers of legislation that suggested we need to take another look at how it was being forwarded.
All right. This one comes from Carol and by email at talk@APRN.org. And it is, what is your opinion of the current state of the current state wildlife management policies? Would you make any changes if you became governor? Well, that's kind of a softball.
Look, there's a huge shortage of scientific research and scientific management of how we do our wildlife management. And I would bolster our ability to understand what's going on with wildlife, both in terms of accessing scientific knowledge and traditional knowledge. I don't believe we do a good enough job integrating the wisdom that the elders have and the people in rural Alaska have about animals. I would like to see a more diversified view in terms of our approach towards wildlife. There's a lot of hunting that occurs in the state. I'm proud of the fact that I've hunted several times over the past several years, and not always successfully, which is fortunate for the people that I go out with. They always get to be a little more successful than I am, and I'm good for cleaning. But we're just not representing the diversity of Alaskan interests when it comes time for wildlife management, and we need to do a better job with that.
Well, let me pursue that a little bit. It's pretty strong feeling in the legislature, and there has been for some time, including the time when you were in there, that the state's constitution really demands that Alaska look for ways to enhance the populations of species that people hunt.
We have to manage for sustained yield, and there are a lot of people in this state who for reasons of subsistence and tradition rely on Alaska's fish and game resources. And we have, I mean, game management, predator management is since time immemorial. All societies that I've ever heard of have managed predators in order to enhance prey species. That's nothing new. It's what we're doing to ensure that people who are in greatest need and who have the greatest cultural reliance on the resource have access to them.
So as governor, would you seek to go back to the subsistence issue in a constitutional form?
I've always been a supporter of a subsistence amendment that allows for a rural priority. I believe that it represents Alaskan values, and I'm also convinced that if we're ever to regain state sovereignty over the federal government in terms of our fish and game management, we need to have a subsistence amendment. But in terms of moving forward, that's something that requires a great deal of consensus, and I'm not sure that the consensus is there at this point. But my position is clear. I believe that subsistence deserves the protection of the Alaskan Constitution.
Ethan Berkowitz is our guest. He's running for governor. He is a Democrat. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. A local call from Anchorage at 550-8422. And email is talk@APRN.org. I want to turn to this matter of law enforcement in rural Alaska. It would appear that the current administration has made some moves, and the legislature also, to increase the VPSO presence there. Is it enough? Do we need more? Where do you stand on this?
You know, I found it really interesting that Sean Parnell all of a sudden says the right things about village public safety officers, but when he was in the legislature and earlier in his career, he opposed the expansion of the VPSO program. And it's part of a pattern I've seen where he speaks nicely and softly one day, but his record reveals something altogether different. I believe we need to do more to enhance law enforcement, but in rural Alaska, and I say this as someone who was a prosecutor in rural Alaska and who spent a lot of time there working, not just politically, but also professionally. But it's not just a law enforcement problem that we confront in rural Alaska. There's drug and alcohol problems that we need to address. There's the incredibly high and tragic rate of suicides that has not received the kind of attention that it should. There's fundamentally, I believe Alaska has a moral imperative, a moral responsibility to make sure that life in the villages is sustainable and is healthy. And we have failed in terms of that responsibility.
What about energy to the bush?
Alaska has incredible potential to deliver affordable energy to rural Alaska. And I've worked with wind diesel projects in the lower Yukon Kuskokwim and tried to also get some wind diesel projects up along the west coast as well. But you look at what we've done and what we haven't done, and this is something I'm incredibly passionate about. You cannot sustain a community, and it's incredibly hard on a family budget when you're paying 80 cents a kilowatt hour, when half of the family's income is going towards utility bills. I've heard too many stories about people who turn off their heat because they can't afford it, or businesses that shut down so the owner can go look for driftwood in order to fire up a furnace and stay warm. That's just not going to do it. We've got more than 100 villages in Alaska that could be taking wind and using wind to offset the high cost of diesel. There's geothermal pretty much along huge swaths of the state. There's in-stream hydro. There's biomass. We've got all kinds of resources that we're not taking advantage of. And what we've seen is a chronic lack of leadership from Juneau on this front. There's been a lot of nice talk, but there's been very little delivery. And the people of rural Alaska in particular have suffered from the high cost of energy. And the point I've made over and over again is every time that a community imports a dollar's worth of diesel, it's exporting a dollar and a job. And we can't continue to do that. I was explaining to you before we went on the air that I worked with the village of Kongiganak. And in Kong, I'm proud that they're putting up 5 wind turbines. It's going to have the greatest degree of wind penetration of any community in the world. And it's not just going to offset diesel for power, but it's also going to offset the requirement for heating oil, because we're going to put in electric stoves in the houses there. We've got to be creative, we've got to be innovative, and we've got to stop wasting money and time, because the villages cannot sustain high cost of energy for much longer.
Well, I wonder about the wasting of time. It seems to me that haste can make waste. And the fact of the matter is, it did take probably longer than it should have to set up the Renewable Energy Fund and put money in it, but they did put money in it. It is true that the governor chose to veto a portion of the renewable energy grants, but, you know, we're talking about the utilities themselves getting up to speed in terms of, and you know, you've worked with utilities, so you have some idea to where they actually have a presentable application, and they've worked things through to to where they can actually execute on these renewable energy ideas, which everybody agrees is a good idea. Are you really sure it can go faster than it has been?
It has got to go faster. And I have a vision that 50 years from now, 100 years from now, every village is energy self-sufficient. Every building is producing some form of energy, and we have the technology to make that happen today. But we have wasted too much time when it comes to, when we realize the opportunities we've squandered. You look, 2-3 years ago, the legislature and the Palin-Parnell administration put out $750-800 million of energy rebates. And that was great. Uncle Sam took a quarter of that in the form of income tax, but that money didn't do one thing to change how we produce or distribute energy in this state. And if we had applied those resources towards solving the energy problem, Alaska would be a global leader in terms of how we produce and distribute energy. We would have gone far down the road in terms of making sure villages had low-cost energy, making sure that the rail belt was finding alternative sources to energy than the natural gas that we're so dependent on from Cook Inlet. So I look at what went on in Juneau at that time, and I say, well, that was great, but didn't the folks there recognize that it was going to get cold and dark the subsequent winter and the winter after that? Just a total lack of leadership. So I disagree when people say we're moving too quickly on the renewable energy. We are moving too slowly, and the problem is the more we delay, the higher the cost. The higher the cost in paying for fuel, the higher the cost when we do pilot project after pilot project after pilot project instead of finding ways of combining our infrastructure investment. Because when you're doing infrastructure investment in rural Alaska and you're paying for the mobilization and demobilization cost of the cranes and the backhoes and all the heavy equipment that's necessary to do construction.
It's so easy to miss the barge season, and then you miss a whole season.
I've seen barges stuck in rivers because the water levels are too low. And if we were smart about this, just dust one of those plans that's sitting on a shelf off and start doing it. This is a chronic problem in the state, is we study things instead of doing things. And we're the beneficiaries of a great legacy. There were some tremendous leaders that the state had, and this is a week for us to remember one of those great leaders, Ted Stevens. But those were people who did things, who had a clear sense of where they wanted to go and just started doing things. And we spend too much time fussing around, studying things and postponing and delaying, and nothing gets done and problems don't get solved.
1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. If calling from Anchorage, it's a local call at 550-8422. Our guest is Ethan Berkowitz. He's running for governor. He is a Democrat. Email is talk@aprn.org. Well, it seems that when it comes, everybody's in favor of renewable energy. Getting from here to there is always the problem, and you're saying, well, we need more leadership, and this is really urgent, and we just damn well have to do it. I think we saw, for instance, during the Murkowski administration that, there were certain things that he thought, well, if we can just get this, and we can get this, we can get that power line, say, over to British Columbia, or whatever, if we can get that mine going down off Lake Iliamna, he had these certain things that he chose to put his emphasis on, and they basically didn't move very fast, and still haven't moved. So what, if you were to pick a couple that you would say, okay, if I'm governor, these are the ones I'm going to push. I'm going to put my chips right on this number here.
Okay. There's two ways of answering that. The first, in terms of the renewable energy, is the biggest problem we have is we don't know what the rules are for independent power producers. So people want to make an investment in a wind turbine or a geothermal facility. They don't know what the rules are in terms of being able to sell that power into the grid, into the local utility. And we've got to clarify those rules, because once we do that, there's a lot of investors who are sitting on the sidelines ready to put their money into Alaska so Alaskans can enjoy the benefits of low-cost, affordable power. But in terms of doing one thing, we need to build a pipeline. We need to build a gas pipeline. And I've watched and I'm frustrated by the inability of the state to move forward on it. I've seen time and again, we're stuck up in the same mentality that we've got to wait for other people to do the job that we should be doing ourselves. We're waiting for big oil to come forward. We're waiting for the federal government. And we have a terrible negotiating posture as far as all that's concerned. When it comes time to developing a gas line, I want to do it now. I want to start with the resources we have. I look at the fact that we go to industry and say, hey, we don't have a fiscal plan, so we're desperate for the revenue that a gas line can provide. We don't have an energy plan, and we're totally desperate for the energy that a gas line is going to provide. And we don't have any credible alternatives than to do business with you, so we have to do business with you. Well, that's a lousy negotiating posture that the state has taken. We've got to be stronger. We've got to be more self-reliant in terms of how we begin to make a gas line a reality. And we can do it on our terms and on our timeline.
What, a bullet line, different tax structure, the incentives that we have now you don't like, in-state gas line? I mean, options are all over the place now, buddy.
I support an all-Alaska pipeline. I think we should start on it now, and we need to make sure that one of the things we do is have the offtakes, so we're creating in-state demand for that gas. We can do that with mining projects like Livengood up north of Fairbanks. We can do that with gas-to-liquids facilities in the interior, and the gas-to-liquids in particular is something that we ought to be looking hard at, because with gas-to-liquid, given the historic discrepancy in the price differential between oil and gas is now relatively cheap compared to oil. We can convert that gas into a fuel, and that satisfies our need for refined product in the state. It's one of the reasons why energy costs are so high, number one. And number two, what this does is add value to a resource. And Alaska is going to be stuck in colonial status until we start adding value to our resources. We can do that with gas.
Ethan Berkowitz, our guest, and Morris joins the program from Nunapichuk. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Morris.
Good morning. Yes, you had talked about resources, Alaska's resources, and what would you do, or what steps would you take that these pipeline jobs, drilling jobs, mining jobs, to keep Alaskans' resources with Alaska jobs, real Alaskans for these jobs that are starting to come to the last frontier.
Thank you, Morris, for that question. I appreciate that. It is critical that when we develop Alaska's resources, Alaskans benefit from developing those resources. And I mean it not just in terms of making money, but also in terms of getting the jobs that go along with it. We can do that by making sure we have a workforce that's trained and ready to step into those jobs. The vocational and technical training that is starting to emerge is giving Alaskans the ability to earn the jobs that pay good wages. I'd also like to make sure that we have the kind of agreements in place with those who are extracting the resource so that they put a premium on Alaskan hire, because that's absolutely essential in my mind for Alaska to derive the maximum benefit from those resources.
Oh, yes, thank you, because there's been a great recession in the lower 48, and it takes time to reach up here, but we just had our census last winter. I wish we could have it next year again, and that would show my question.
Well, there's, you know, I look at what's going on in the hubs. You've got the People's Learning Center in Bethel. You have Kotzebue Tech up in Kotz. You have Avtech in Seward. There are regional training centers that we need to build more. And I also look at one of the great problems the state has is so many young people who start high school don't finish it. And it's 40% of young people across the state, 60% in rural Alaska. And if we give those young people an avenue of hope, give them the skills so that they can get jobs, I believe it's one of the ways we can keep kids in school and make sure that they can have control over their lives and be healthier, not just physically, not just in terms of being able to take care of themselves, but also in terms of generating strong, healthy communities.
Thank you very much.
All right, Morris, thank you very much. Yeah, it's. I think we'll probably end up getting back to that issue of jobs in rural Alaska. You can go back and look at the Trans-Alaska Pipeline and Alyeska's local hire record, and it never did get very good despite all the different efforts in the Native hire effort, despite all the efforts. Red Dog, maybe they made a little progress there, and maybe that's a model, but I know also that that's been an ongoing struggle, and it's largely because the Native Corporation is an owner that they're able to insist on shareholder hire. So I think we'll get back to that one with Ethan Berkowitz as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA.
It's Talk of Alaska. Ethan Berkowitz is our guest. He's running for governor as a Democrat. He ran for U.S. House earlier, and for a while he was ahead of Don Young, I mean, in the vote count, but that's just not how it ended up turning out. Now he is running for governor. He's strong on renewable energy, as we've heard, and we were just getting to some of the nuts and bolts of economic development and local hire, because it, and you know, very rightly you brought up workforce qualification, because that's usually the excuse that's used. Well, we just can't find the qualified people.
You know, and I've always found it incredibly ironic that we're a state that exports resources and imports workforce. It just strikes me as being the kind of dynamic we ought to change a little bit.
Yeah. So I think you mentioned something like maybe putting caveats into the contracts when the state get some business, like their project labor agreement.
Like project labor agreements where we can do that. There's also ways, I believe, where Alaskans can have a greater degree of ownership in the resources themselves. And you talked about the NANA example up with Red Dog, where NANA was able to insist on shareholder hire. And we ought to facilitate those kind of arrangements as much as possible.
Okay, well, let's go up into Northwest Alaska and the village of Deering, where Ron joins the program. Ron, you're on the air with Ethan Berkowitz. You might want to turn your radio down. Sounds like it's coming in the background there. Now we hear him go to his radio.
Okay, I turned it off.
Thanks. Okay, you're on the air with Ethan.
Yeah, good morning. I'd like to thank Ethan for traveling our villages up here in Northwest. And my subject today is, you know, we do a lot of subsistence hunting up here in our area. And, you know, we've been reading on, you know, how Anilka was created on the Tidal Lake for subsistence hunting for our, you know, our people up here. And what's the future for, you know, like doing 8-10 analysis on a lot of our lands to Park Service and the Secretary of Interior. You know, it takes them 15 months to get analysis done, you know, to force our hunting and gathering of food that we live on up here. And what do you see for the future, Ethan?
Ron, thanks for the question, and thanks for noticing when I was traveling around. It's one of my favorite parts of the state, and I'm happy that most of my subsistence experience has been spent in your region, at Fish Camp, up the Kobuk, And I do think that we need to do more to make sure that the federal government is more responsive to local understanding and local requirements when it comes to subsistence. And some of this has to do with the strength of tribal entities to express themselves with co-management agreements. Some of this has to do with having a administration in Juneau, a governor who's friendly and supportive of subsistence, which, as you know, I'm incredibly supportive of, and Sean Parnell has opposed consistently. So I will always listen to what the people in rural Alaska have to say about subsistence and be responsive as greatly as I can be.
Ron?
Okay. Thank you, Ethan, and yes.
All right. Thanks for your call, Ron, from all the way up in Deering, Northwest Alaska. This one comes from Gene, who lives in Eagle. And they may not be able to drive in and out of Eagle, but they've got email. And she says, for decades, the Taylor Highway has been slated for upgrade. It's one of just two road systems entering our state. To date, only one-third of this promised upgrade has been completed, and we see all kinds of crazy erosion happening on that road. When will the state fulfill its promise to complete the upgrade of the Taylor Highway?
You know, the state hasn't done a highway in a long time, and I think it's time we change that. There's two things I'd like to point out, and maybe the first is we've wasted more than $100 million over the last 5 years or so doing road studies and surveys for projects that were never, ever going to get built or completed. And had we taken that $100 million plus and put it towards projects that we know needed work, that we could have actually accomplished something with that money, put people to work, built the infrastructure that the state needs. Taylor Highway, say fixing some of the more dangerous parts of the Seward Highway, the Eagle River bottleneck, all of these projects we could have accomplished had we spent our money wisely with a plan. So I will make sure that we deal with the Taylor Highway project as quickly as possible. I'd also like to point out that we've got crying infrastructure needs in this state, not just in terms of roads and ports and harbors, but we're far behind the curve on contemporary infrastructure like broadband. And I spent a good chunk of the last year or so working on a major broadband project that would have brought or will bring fiber optic, high-speed fiber optic to high-speed internet to more than 160 villages across Western Alaska. And though the advantages of that kind of infrastructure help link communities together, help create opportunity, and make sure that all Alaskans have equal access to the state's resources.
You and I both know, and probably not too many of our listeners do, that when we lost Ted Stevens, we lost one of the foremost advocates of telecommunications development and telecommuting in the Congress. And I don't know who's going to pick that up, but apparently there's a great deal more potential that's being used than is being used. After reading through the technical reports, there could be far more telecommuting now by federal employees than is allowed.
We can do not just telecommuting, but I look at what's happened is we tend to view, or the traditional view is that if we bring broadband to rural Alaska, rural Alaska will be able to benefit from services that are provided elsewhere. But I see broadband as being a two-way street. We'll be able to create jobs in rural Alaska where people in the villages are providing services to people in Anchorage, to people in Chicago, to people in Paris. And we have the ability to put this kind of infrastructure together, and we just need to get the job done. This is another instance of we're waiting for somebody else to make things happen instead of getting on it and doing it ourselves.
I guess theoretically, if you do get fiber going across the Arctic Ocean or going up and touching base up there along the north, that you'll have these nodes that are capable of doing something like Bob Gillum did years ago, where he realized he could do day trading out of Alaska.
Well, we've, you know, the project that I've been working on would run a fiber cable from Kodiak down to Unalaska, up along the hubs of Western Alaska and into Prudhoe. And it's such a solid project that we were able to attract national and international partners and investors who are interested now in running the project from Prudhoe to Britain and from Unalaska to Japan. And if you have that kind of fiber highway, that kind of linkage, it's going to be absolutely essential for when the Arctic opens up because of the retreating sea ice. It's critical for understanding and doing research on climate change. You can do all kinds of monitoring on a continual live basis with that kind of access. It's critical for life safety issues, telemedicine, for distance delivery of education. It just makes all the difference in communities that are isolated when they don't need to be.
Okay, well, it's bound to happen, Ethan Berkowitz. It's time for some fish questions.
Oh, great.
Are you ready?
I am.
All right, the first one is basically saying, under the limited entry system, which of course preceded the CDQ and the processor quotas and so forth like that, we now have a situation where it's almost impossible for young people, unless they get onto a crew, to get a permit to go fishing for salmon, which is one of our big natural resources in any marine community. Can something be done about that?
You know, the time I spent in Bristol Bay, it became quickly apparent that every boat was a small family business. And the more we can do to make sure that those small family businesses remain in the next generation's hands, the more we can sustain a way of life. And fishing is more than just a job. It's a way of life, and I think it's part of Alaska's identity. There are things we can do to make sure that the entry permits don't wind up outside the state. And there are buyback options that we can engage in. There's restrictions on who can purchase them, making sure that and the buyback options are options that we've used in the past in other instances. So I'd like to pursue those because we've got to maintain the ability of coastal communities to keep fishing as a vital part of their economies and their way of life.
Well, the state used to do more in terms of capitalizing people buying permit capacity, and that's kind of gone by the wayside through
right.
the years.
Right. The loan programs haven't been enough. There has been, frankly, also inadequate support for health care for fishermen and fishing families. Those are issues we need to take care of. And we can't ignore the problem of commercial fisheries and hope that they'll solve themselves. We have a role in this state. I mean, the state came into statehood over the commercial fisheries issue, trying to make sure that we had control over them and control over the fisheries and the benefit of those resources flowed to Alaskans. And that challenge exists today.
Okay, down to Cook Inlet, where Christy says, how do you feel about the dip netting? They are trying to manage over escapement with dip netting, and of course this favors the people that dip net. And she says, "We're still getting over escapement. Is there a better way to go?"
You know, I've waded into streams as a dip netter, but I'm not wading into allocation decisions. I will say one of the great concerns I have with Cook Inlet salmon is the intercept that's taking place of salmon and bycatch of salmon in the Gulf of Alaska. And we need to do more to reduce the bycatch because that's a waste of a resource. And instead of fighting over which particular allocation, let's make sure that there are more fish in the streams, make sure the habitat is protected, make sure that the stocks aren't being wasted with intercept fisheries that aren't taking advantage of the economic value of those fish.
Well, let's turn to other sources of food, like, for instance, agriculture. And Danny Konzenstein just had to get this in, of course. With our current food system, Alaskans export over 95% of our food dollars to the lower 48. Very little of our food is grown or produced in Alaska. Do you have any ideas about how the state could support a stronger local food system? And you know, funny thing, you talk to the old timers, we used to have it. We used to have more root cellars and all sorts of stuff we don't have anymore.
Yeah, I'm proud of the fact that I'm the only person running for statewide office that actually has an agricultural policy, and I posted it on my website, ethanberkowitz.com, and I encourage people to look at it. We've got to do more to grow our own food. We can. It's healthier. It creates jobs here in the state. It creates an economy, you know, and I look at what we've not done in adequate support for community-supported agriculture. A lot of that going on up in the Fairbanks area, some out in the valley. We don't don't have enough cold storage so that we can grow product and store it here in state. We're not encouraging rural Alaskans with low-cost energy to grow more of their own. There's a fellow by the name of Myers out in Bethel who's doing a lot in terms of root vegetables, which I didn't used to like until I started eating local product. But it's all part and parcel of how we can be independent and self-reliant. And we don't grow near enough of our own food. And if people aren't concerned, think about this. We've only got about 3 or 4 days worth of food on our shelves. The standard is about 3 weeks. And Alaska's emergency food house and food warehouses, it's in Oregon. Those are problems that need to be fixed.
Okay, Ethan Bergowitz, pretty strong on local food. 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage of 550-8422, email talk at aprn.org. Building right up to the primary election just a week from today, and Ethan Bergowitz is running for governor as a Democrat. We'll go to Guy in Valdez. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Ethan Bergowitz, Guy.
Good show, Steve. Ethan, you were just talking about, you know, local food and stuff. Well, you know, all of our food is trucked up here, you know. And if
actually, what, in Valdez you're talking about?
Hey, Steve, all you got to do is go over to Tok and watch the semis come into the state from Beaver Creek there and see how much of our stuff is brought up by truck. And if we were connected with rail, you know, we could bring business up here. You know, we could end up, we have one grocery store here in Valdez, and it's getting to the point where you have to go over and buy bulk over in the valley or Anchorage, and then come back here and then pick up what you need. But it's getting expensive. Fuel's getting expensive. You know, the food's getting expensive. If we were connected by rail, we could bring the prices down on this stuff, and maybe we could end up also getting other companies to come up here, because we're not. You know, we're like a third world country up here. And I'm going to take my answers off the air, but Ethan, there'd be something that you can get people working, and, you know, because once it's done, there's going to be people having to work on the rails, and, you know, we need this. We need this. This state needs to get connected to the rest of this continent, and I'll take my answers off the air. Thank you.
Okay. If we were put down tracks, where would they go? Along the Alaska Highway or where?
Well, I don't know how they'd get to the lower 48, and I think that's always been an intriguing prospect for us, because we do need to move products, our resources south, but I'd like to see us do that after we'd added value to them. There's another rail link that people don't talk about that much, but that's the link in the Northwest Arctic between Point Hope, where there's fairly large resources, mineral resources available, and the Nome area, where there's discussion of having a new open water port. And if we can do that, we can move the resources of the Arctic into the shipping lanes pretty quickly and pretty efficiently. So we've got to be open to all kinds of infrastructure development in this state. We can do it in a way that balances our responsibility to be good stewards of the environment and good conservationists with the responsibility we have to make sure our people have jobs and that Alaskans are the beneficiaries of the resources that exist in this state.
Ethan Bergowitz is our guest as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development.
Talk. We got a big pile of email inquiries for Ethan Bergowitz, and I'll go with this one from Tom in Talkeetna, who points out that, basically he's going to get on you about criticizing ACES. He said you could easily have defended it. He points out that ConocoPhillips' 12% investment in Alaska has brought home an average of 36% of their worldwide earnings and profits. ACES subsidized Conoco, Exxon, and BP to develop oil fields in Iraq for as little as $1.39 a barrel. I remember the blood battle during the special session over ACEs, and now Ethan wants to negotiate field by field with the best negotiators and lobbyists money can buy. Sorry, this lifelong Democrat has always voted for Ethan. Not this time in the primary and not in the general. I will vote for Sean Parnell before I vote for a pandering, self-aggrandized Democrat like Ethan has now become. Tom and Talkeetna.
Well, it's always nice to have an honest discussion with somebody who's
on email.
Look, I'm not afraid of negotiating with the oil companies. I'm not naive. I know they're tough negotiators. As I've said many times before, we're not retreating from the gains of making sure Alaska receives its fair share of oil revenue. It's something I fought hard for. I will continue to fight hard for. I think it is absolutely important that before any negotiations take place, there be a set of statutory requirements that be included in any kind of contract. That's the way the world exists today. Those are the statutory requirements that exist under current circumstances with both royalty relief that's available to companies today. And it's also the way it is when I look at the legislature start to carve out exceptions to ACEs, Cook Inlet gas being a notable instance at this time. So I hope I get Tom's vote back in time for the primary and for the general. If he looks closely at what I've said, it's far different than the way my political opponents have characterized it. I will also say for the final time, or hopefully the final time, that I'm very happy that people worked hard to make ACEs pass. But standing pat in a changing world is a dangerous recipe. And the gains that people feel they made with ACEs are gains that can be undone very quickly. And in order to protect Alaska's fair share, you need to have a structure in place that guarantees that we won't backslide.
This one came in by telephone to the control room, and they just typed it over to me. He said, if Berkowitz wants to put 80% of our tax on oil companies into the permanent fund, how do you run state government on just 20%?
I haven't said 80%. I want 100%. I want 100% of our...
You want to run it all through the permanent fund?
I want to run everything through the permanent fund or a permanent account because... And it's not something, a transition that happens overnight. This is something it's going to take a while to evolve to. And we can do that but the idea is you got to protect our wealth instead of spending our money.
There is another... This one, let's see. Denali Kid Care, where you at on that one?
I've always been a supporter of expanding Denali Kid Care, and I am appalled at Sean Parnell's raw pandering where he eliminated Denali Kid Care. I think it was either incompetent, hypocritical, or worse for him to eliminate Denali Kid Care. And I've watched the Parnell approach to health care, and his whole agenda is no. No to Denali Kid Care. No to allowing kids who are under 26 to remain on their parents' health insurance. No to anything. That's not a health care plan. We need to do things so the Alaskans have access to health care, and it's not just in terms of access to insurance. It's access to the health care itself, and we ought to have a medical school in the state. We ought to allow Alaskans to buy insurance over state lines. We ought to allow Alaskans to pool together if that's what they feel that they want to do in order to acquire the right kind of insurance. So saying no is not a plan. Doing something is absolutely essential so Alaskans have the security that comes from quality health care.
Bob joins the program from Thorn Bay. Bob, you're on the air with Ethan Berkowitz.
Yes, Mr. Berkowitz. I'm in Southeast, and you're probably aware of our dismal economic situation down here. Have you any ideas or plans for revitalizing down here, especially our timber industry? About the only heavy industry we have down here now is that tour guide. We've got population leaving. We've got wages falling. Basically no job for our young people. Okay, I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, Bob, and you look at what's going on in Southeast with the number of people that are leaving the region, and that's the saddest testimony you have to how hard the economy is landing on folks. And we need to do more than just tourism. That's a seasonal industry at best. We need to bolster the commercial fisheries that are operational down there, make sure we're adding value to those fish instead of simply taking the fish product and sending them offshore to be processed where other people can make the profits from it. With our timber industry, as small as it is, there are opportunities there for us to expand the timber in ways where we're adding value to it. And we just haven't done that. And we haven't set the policies in place where we could do that. You know, I remember when Tony Knowles was governor, there was more state land available for timber harvest than there have been since. And we can go back to those kind of policies if we do things the right way, paying attention to the people on the ground and developing solutions that work. I'll also say I think it's critical for Southeast that you have a ferry system that's affordable and reliable and that links the communities in ways that they currently aren't linked.
Well, nobody's mentioned it, so I guess I will. What about that road? Would you put the road north from Juneau out of its misery?
I think there's been an awful lot of money thrown at that road, and there hasn't been a lot of pavement. And I frankly don't see how you can pay for that kind of road with the current budgets that exist into the state or the federal government.
Okay. And it does use a lot of our federal highway money.
And that money could be better spent on projects that we know we can accomplish and projects that alleviate congestion and make for safer roads.
Okay, this one from Amanda, who is a contractor, and says, here I am with all kinds of job qualifications and a degree, but there's just not the job generation. Once you get outside of government, the jobs just aren't here. People have had to leave. I had to leave. No sustainable salary. What can you do about jobs?
We need to invest in our educational system. We need to invest in our infrastructure. And if we do that, then we're going to create the right kind of economic climate for job creation to exist. We've got an educational system right now where 40% of the kids who start high school don't finish it. That's not good enough for the state. We've got an infrastructure deficit in Alaska that leaves us unable to compete with other places in the country and other places in the world. We're far behind in broadband. We're far behind in terms of, we're last in broadband connectivity in this state on average. We don't have the ports, we don't have the rail links, we don't have the harbors, and we've got to aggressively go after building that kind of infrastructure so we can move our resources to market and add value to that resources so we can have sustainable jobs. But you need to have the policies in place that recognizes the importance of workforce development, and value added. And we frankly don't have that right now.
It looks like the incentives are working for the one industry that is doing more locating up here is the movie business. Some of it may just be the Palin factor, but still.
No, I think it's more than that. There's a recognition, and this is something.
And this was just a small incentive that was passed.
That's right. And when Frank Murkowski closed down the film office years ago, I railed against him at that point, saying that this is ridiculous. I mean, it's a relatively small investment that attracts some high dollar and high profile industry to Alaska. And I know that there was some work done, and they were able to restore the film incentives. I think that's a positive step, but it's also a recognition that if you create the right kind of incentives, you can build industry here in Alaska. And I hope that the lessons of the film industry are translated more broadly as well.
Barbara, you got just a minute with Ethan Berkowitz if you got a question. Barbara in Anchorage. Hello, Barbara. Barbara's busy listening to the radio, I guess. Okay. Well, gosh, everything that I have on my table requires a whole lot of detail, so I think you get to make a closing statement.
Well, thanks, Stephen. It's a pleasure, and I look forward to coming back and discussing issues at greater length with the audiences across Alaska. We are in a situation now in this state where we have choices to make, choices about the direction we're going to take, choices about whether we're going to remain complacent, whether mediocrity is good enough for us, or whether it's time for us to live up to the finest traditions that we have of doing things. And I offer my candidacy in the hopes of getting things done. Building a gas line, being tough enough to negotiate with not just the oil industry, but also the financial market, so we can make something that's been a dream into a reality. Concrete plans for bringing low-cost renewable energy to communities across the state so communities can be sustainable, and an educational system that leaves Alaskans able to compete with people anywhere in the world. So what we've got just isn't good enough. What we can have is so much better.
Hey, that was fairly nicely timed. Thank you so much, Ethan Berkowitz.
I'm listening to the music.
It's handy that way. Our next Talk of Alaska happens on Thursday, and our guest will be Senator Lisa Murkowski. It's Talk of Alaska, Dave Waldron on the controls, and Kristen Spock has moved over to the telephones along with BD Trantina. I'm Steve Heimel. Thank you for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. If you smoke, odds are you want to quit. And if you want to quit, you're probably finding it tough to do. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line can help. The average smoker tries 10 times before they quit for good. You can increase your chances by calling the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line. A trained quit coach is waiting for your call. Give it a shot. It's free and it works. Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-888-842-7848. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.